Welcome to part three of our conversation with Jonathan Guston. And we just keep on rolling in the logos. So you might want to take notes and stop and meditate on a lot of the things that came out, because this is really, really brilliant and inspiring and deeply motivating. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit. Life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution.
You know what I realized is we haven't defined metacrisis. I'd love to hear from you two, or I can start if you want.
Yeah, why don't you start there? It's a key term and one we've used on this podcast several times, but it's a concept that's still in being filled out, I think, by our collective culture. And I'd love to hear, I think our listeners would love to hear how you understand it, Jonathan, at this moment.
Exactly. Until tomorrow, when I watch a great YouTube video and go, oh my God, that's so much better. Well, I have a short definition of the metacrisis today, which might not last until tomorrow. And it's something like the polycrisis, the multiple interrelated crises, plus the consciousness in which the polycrisis arises and is ultimately made of. Let me break that down a little bit. Obviously, the polycrisis is not, the origins of it don't lie in, you know, the aardvarks, armadillos, and giraffes. They are not responsible for it. It's humans. Well, then the question is, why? Why would we do these things? Why would we create, you know, 30,000 warheads that could just destroy and create a nuclear winter? For that, the polycrisis science is not going to be able to answer the question. And so now we come to the word meta, which just simply means, you know, post or beyond. And so what is beyond or underneath or within and between all the elements of the polycrisis? What is the interstitial, the tissue? And I would say it's consciousness, human consciousness that suffers in part from this delusion of separation. So I say meta because it's an attempt at explaining, or the container in which the polycrisis arises. So that's one element for me of going beyond the polycrisis and seeing what is its sort of ground, its origins. So that's my short definition. I can fill that out a little more, but maybe you two want to just offer your short definition first.
Well, the image that came up for me is a holographic image. You know, you have a picture of you, for example, and it has all your individual parts and what's everything that's around you, and they're all individual, discrete, important things. But if you cut a little piece off and you look into it, it contains the whole in every individual part. And that seems to me as a really helpful image of trying to understand it. And also helpful if we're working on, you know, we found a road, and this is what we're working with drug addicts or working with, you know, whatever it might be, to realize that it's all interconnected. And in the service of the one, you're serving the one also. So it might help.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I think I hadn't thought of putting the meta crisis as linking that as you've done to the polycrisis being more physical, visible aspects of the meta crisis, but I think that's a nice connection that the meta crisis is a sum total of the challenges we face for our civilization and species and our planet, plus the psychological, spiritual, cultural roots and dysfunctions from which they stem. And the interesting implication is that what we call our global crises are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective psychological and spiritual immaturities and dysfunctions. And what that implies is that we cannot, as you said, Jonathan, simply engineer our way out of these challenges, because we will not only fail to address their causes, we'll be simply doing Band-Aid treatment, and we will be treating symptoms and not causes, and we will create more problems and more crises, just as we have throughout history. And we are going to have to, as the implication is, we are going to have to heal and mature and awaken ourselves sufficiently, individually and collectively, if we are to make our way through this evolutionary and technological bottleneck that we have created, and not blow ourselves out of existence or poison ourselves or any number of other things that we may well do. And unfortunately, in addition to polycrisis and metacrisis, I think this is a permacrisis, because with accelerating technology, we will always henceforth, unless we collapse our civilization, have the technological power to put ourselves and our planet and our species at risk, so that we are forever now going to have to emphasize the growth of maturity and wisdom and virtues and capacities to sufficiently balance out the incredible imbalance between our technological power and our wisdom deficits. We've become nuclear giants and technological wizards while remaining ethical infants and wisdom fetuses. So we have a lot of work to do. But unfortunately, the psychological and cultural and spiritual roots aren't much recognized. And this is where your contribution is so important, Jonathan, that you recognize the roots of the metacrisis and the polycrisis, and are trying to introduce both the recognition of their inner causes plus the practices which will address the immaturities and pathologies at their root. Very important work.
Ah, another perfect Dharma talk. Thank you.
Well said.
Yeah. Yes, so beautifully said. And I like that you introduced the word, the term, you know, permacrisis, permanent, right? So it's a perma-poly-crisis, which is to say a permanent, multiple relating, interrelating crises that make up the totality of the perma poly crisis. And then the meta crisis is a way of holding that with, you know, the way I got to my understanding, or part of it, is the word metaphysics. So you have physics, which you can see, you know, under a microscope and through scientific investigation, and then metaphysics, what is after or beyond physics or underlies it. And so that was my question, like, why do we keep doing this? You know, climate change is just one, and then there's ecosystem collapse and on and on and on. And I think the word, the term, even though I can't say, oh, I really understand the meta crisis, the term itself is this like koan, it's this investigation into our relationship with life and reality. And the primary question, I think, is not just what is the meta crisis, but if you want to say a few more things, it's like, what do I take myself and the world to be? What is this? Right? Because I have an idea of who and what I am and an idea of life, and it evolves. And without that evolution, I like what you said, Roger, crisis, it's the symptoms. So if you have a person who's ODing on drugs, you do want to do the Band-Aid approach. You want to pump out their stomach. You want to help them. There's the emergency things, and we're going to need to do that. The understanding of the meta crisis is not going to save us in the next few weeks or months or even a year or two. So yes, we are going to have to reduce emissions. Yes, we're going to have to do carbon sequestration if it works. Yes, we're going to probably, and this scares me, but we're probably going to have to do some geoengineering until such time as we can bring down the emissions and go to a truly clean, you know, energy that doesn't have a lot of drawbacks. Meanwhile, that's the band-aids that gets us through the next maybe decade or two or three or however many it is. So that's addressing the poly crisis today. What can we do? At the same time, what is driving, and John, you know, you probably have a lot to say on this. What is driving the addiction to the delusion of separation in a way like an addict would do? And how can we get to the underlying elements such that that craving, that desire, that lifestyle, that impulse is reduced? Be not, you know, taken away completely. So I don't know if John, if that metaphor, or that analogy rather, feels apt to you.
Sure. And addiction is still a mystery.
Yeah.
Still like, really? You know, all what happens in the brain and the chemistry and brain chemistry, et cetera, and the physical aspect, but the actual thing yourself is almost like consciousness, you know. Explain that one to me, you know, and that which can be named the Tao is not the Tao. It's a great mystery. And it's the hard question of human existence. Given all this, and the many of us recognize, why do we keep behaving like this? You know, why? And given what the mystics and the great teachers teach us about the ultimate nature of reality, what's up, folks? You know, let's say we're all friends instead of enemies and love each other and all creatures. That would be a hell of a lot more fun.
So, Jonathan, what else about the meta crisis?
I want to touch on something I call default purpose. So in my work as a purpose guide, I don't believe that we take people from not having a purpose to having a purpose. That's just not the way I see it. It's fine if people see it that way. I think people land on some kind of provisional or inherited or default purpose that offers some level of guidance. It can be simply, you know, I want a lot of money and be happy with my family. Just like, you know, I wouldn't mind a lot of money, and I like being happy with my family. So it's not necessarily a pathological thing, but it's not the only thing. And so a default purpose, of course, can become pathological if, you know, my lust for money just continues and continues and continues. If all I care about is just my own son and my wife and nothing else. So one of the things I help people to identify is their inherited or default purpose. See what elements of it are true, indigenous for them, and which parts aren't. A lot of times people will come and they'll already say, I know that some of the values or religion or traditions that I was brought up in don't feel resonant with me. But then there's that bardo period, that in between your default or inherited purpose and your true purpose or your soul level purpose is the way I usually say it. And that's the kind of underworld journey to soul, to use sort of the, you know, a shamanic term. And I think that is one of the journeys that we need to take as a species, as individuals. What is the purpose of our lives? What is the purpose of our species? What is the purpose of Canada and the United States? What does it mean? And so, you know, for me, I don't concentrate at the level of nations. I wouldn't really necessarily know how to do that. But I know some people are working with corporations or businesses, but I work with individuals. And so if we can bring that question into the non-dual traditions that don't presence that, I think that's very important. Because if you're just sitting there and you're doing your, you know, meditation practice, but you're not attending to that developmental aspect, then default purpose can stay the same. And I remember Terry Patton coming back from Iran and reporting to me, you know, he's a great integral teacher. And he came back and he said, oh yeah, he met like one of the attendants to the Ayatollah Khomeini. And he was in the little room that, you know, he used to meditate. He said it was very powerful. And that he had some reason to believe that there was a deep spiritual depth to this man. And yet, if that were true, I've never met him and I don't have an opinion on this, it's possible to have this great epiphany and awakening and snap right back to your traditional or even pre-traditional and personal default purpose. That is something that Zen and Advaita Vedanta hasn't really, you know, that they haven't been the elements that have taught me that. And so part of the metta of the metta crisis, the metta symptoms, is to acknowledge we probably have default purposes, some of which we're aware of, some of which are semi or unconscious, to bring that into awareness, to skillfully see what is truly mine and what isn't, and then to look forward and say, wait a minute. Like my parents never said to me at the dinner table what I say to my son. I say, son, did you know secreted within you is a deep soul level purpose? And if you're interested, and you might not be, you can attend to it, come into relationship with it, and embody it in a way that is a gift to your people. And he listens and he goes, okay, I got it. You know, it's a seed and we'll see what happens. It's his destiny. My parents said, what do you want to do when you grow up? Which wasn't a bad question, because of course it turned out after I graduated college, I needed to earn my living. But it stopped there. It was just about survival and to some degree comfort. So I think this is part of the metta, is what is our relationship to meaning, story, cosmology, and what I would call soul level purpose, and really recognizing the default aspect.
Yeah. And so this is a beautiful approach, Jonathan. And what the question in the koan you're raising for me is, given that all of us, we can't live without purpose, just can't, like we can't live with a faith, but faith, as James Fowler pointed out, can go through a number of developmental stages. And what I think you're pointing to is that purpose can go through a number of developmental stages. And so what I would love to know is, what have you found are the characteristics of the most mature, helpful, best purposes?
What are the characteristics of the most helpful purposes?
Yeah. If one looks, what are the characteristics of optimal motives?
Of a healthy, soul-centric, world-centric purpose.
Yeah. Oh, what a great question. Well, let's dig into it together. Let's see what bubbles up.
I say this, I think lack of purpose sets one up for all kinds of suffering.
Yes.
Addiction, depression, inappropriate sexual adventurism, just spinning out of control because you don't have that anchoring thing. No, I'm not going to do this because I have something that's more important that I have to attend to. And without that anchor, especially some of us, man, we can really spin out.
Yeah, lack of purpose. I sometimes just don't understand why it isn't talked about more. It wasn't in grade school. It wasn't in high school. It wasn't in college. And frankly, it wasn't even that much in graduate school.
Well, we were taught how to make a living, not a life.
Right.
Oh, we were taught how to make a living, not how to make a life. That says it all. Yeah. Yeah. To transcend and include making a living. Of course we need to make a living. And what I try to, you know, share with my son is like, yeah, absolutely. You know, acquire some skill set that resonates with you, that you love. He was telling me, oh, I want to be a lawyer. Why do you want to be a lawyer? So I earn a ton of money. And I'm like, what will you do with your ton of money, son? Oh, I'll have a whole car collection. Well, what will you do with that? And, you know, so let him dream. Fine. Great. But then I make a point. I'm like, you know, lawyers work really hard for all that money. I know a lawyer. It's 12 hours a day. I said, you know, if you don't do what you love, that's going to be a real drag. And furthermore, enjoy your fancy car. Lovely. But if you feel like what you're doing is sort of meaningless and flat, you are setting yourself up. You're exposing yourself to the potential of, yeah, drugs, sexual adventures that go sideways and so forth. So if that's your only purpose, to earn a boatload of money, I would say that's a high, high risk proposition. And so what is it to, you know, not just make a living, but to have a life? Yeah, amen to that.
Yeah, caring for your family, caring for your children. I mean, you know, this circle of care just keeps getting larger and larger, you know, as we develop and mature spiritually and emotionally. And that's a good thing. If I don't, you know, if I don't, they used to say when I was a kid, to get a good job, get a good education. That was the one thing that was hammered in. So what did I do? I dropped out of school when I was 14, you know, like, and that's a whole other story, but, and I had, they could have sent me to any school that I would work hard enough to get into. And I hopefully I made up for it, but I felt the deficit. Yeah. For a long time.
And I think, John, you just pointed to one of the characteristics, at least it seems to me, one of the characteristics of a mature, optimal purpose, and that is that the purpose includes, it has a wide circle of concern and care.
So one of the terms I like to use is the difference between a human-centric non-duality and an ecocentric non-duality. Now, some people take issue, well, wait a minute, Jonathan, non-duality is everything, so what are you even saying? So within a certain frame, I want to point out that a lot of non-dual spirituality, I'll speak from my own tradition, Zen and Advaita Vedanta, is either overtly or covertly kind of centered on the human being, which is fine. Humans are beautiful and need attention and care, and spiritual growth and awakening is very important. But of course, when you awaken, when the Buddha awakened, he awakened to all, he said, all things are awakening. So I don't think what I'm proposing is a new type of non-duality, as much as it would like flatter me to have invented one. I haven't. Within actual total reality, non-duality is eco non-duality. But I think we need the term now so that we kind of flush out the whole of what it is. When we wake up to a love and a responsibility to all things. And this is a joyous thing. It's not experienced as a burden. It's experienced as an extension of what we actually are. Back to that writing on the back of the Zen robe, throughout the universe, one body revealed. That, I guess, was the seed of my understanding of eco non-duality.
Beautiful. And we had a guest on some time back, David Loy, a Zen teacher and philosopher, brilliant man, whose work I'm sure you know. And he had a couple of concepts that I just love. One is eco-dharma, which feels like a beautiful complement to the terms you're using. And along with being a bodhisattva, be an eco-sattva.
Yeah. Amen. You know, in a sense, because non-duality can be so, have an accent of attention on the transcendent, that embodiment piece is key, because non-duality can, in a strange way, show the inability to narrate its own demise. Here we are meditating in monasteries and in our homes and so forth, because it is so precious. It's so beautiful. It's so good. And in order to be responsible to the lineage, to the teachings, to the beauty, goodness, and truth of this, of these lineages, now there is no choice, in my opinion, to have it be an eco non-duality or an eco dharma, as you were saying. So to narrate that, I think those sorts of stories, sometimes they're like, oh no, we want to transcend all stories. But the story or narrative of what's happening in this polycrisis is itself, to see it, is the meta crisis or meta solution view that can actually enable us to move through it in a successful way.
Yeah, beautifully said. Let's see, there are a couple of things I'd like to get into, but you had another topic you wanted to address, Jonathan.
I think I kind of did. I call it the unit of enlightenment. which is, I know, it's a crazy term, and it breaks down pretty fast. But when you read a lot of the books, it looks like we're just talking about a transformation in consciousness of the individual. But what we really realize, right? And I think this just needs to be just put a little more in the foreground and then connected with the meta crisis, is that we wake up to awareness, see everything as arising in awareness. We're that which notices what arises in awareness, and everything is made of that. And when we hold the poly crisis, then we're kind of I feel, I experience being sort of launched or pushed up into that meta understanding and a meta response to the Pali crisis. So if the unit of enlightenment, if the teacher, the big teacher were to be in the stage and say, okay, waking up as a species and not just as a one-off line, but what does that really mean to dig into that, to co-explore? A koan is actually a public event because you go to your Zen teacher and you share with that Zen teacher what you've experienced. They test you. And so one of the questions a non-dual teacher can ask now is, what is the meta crisis? What is your response to the meta crisis? How are you the meta crisis? These questions are like 21st century updates. And I think that's one of the things we need to do is update, not throw out the traditional Zen and Advaita and Dzogchen and Mahamudra. No. God, no. But it's 2024.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It had never occurred to me that one could update the koans to be current, as you're pointing out, and to more than current, dealing with the great issues of our time. So this is, I think that's a beautiful idea.
And immensely more helpful. Yes. I mean, it's really a good move.
Yeah. Who said that the book of the koan, the Blue Cliff Record or whatever it may be, Dogen and others offered beautiful koans. What was your original face before your parents were born? Ah, wow. I'd cut my right arm off to have written that. But that still is incredibly relevant. But another is, what is the meta crisis? Whoa. And why would we only use things that were written in the past? Is there the possibility of writing a current koan that actually specifically sort of changes the unit of enlightenment from person to the entire planet?
That's beautiful, Jonathan. And I got a little transmission then as you posed that koan, what is the meta crisis? Because I can see, the traditional one of the way of understanding the goal of a koan is that it's a non-intellectual question. It can't be consoled by dualistic conceptualization. And it stuns the intellect into cessation, revealing the awareness behind it. And what is the meta crisis certainly stuns this intellect into silence, because there's no way of comprehending it. In fact, so many people have acknowledged that this meta crisis is larger than any perspective, in one perspective or conceptualization, et cetera, et cetera. So it does kind of stun the mind, or at least stun mine for a few seconds there into silence. And yes, with that, there is the potential for a kensho, a glimpse of one's true nature. So yeah, thank you. I'd never thought of that before. That's wonderful.
I'm curious, in your own tradition, so are you practice in the Dzogchen Mahamudra tradition? Well, you say what you practice in, and then I'm curious, within that tradition or traditions, maybe not koans, but is there a kind of an update or move or an inclusion to the Pali permacrisis, the meta crisis that is bubbling up in you?
Well, my late wife called me spiritually promiscuous. So I have explored, as you have, all of us have a number of traditions. I would say it depends very much on the individual teacher. There are some teachers there's a spectrum. Some people are very traditional and you listen to them, you're hearing what their teacher said under some tree a couple of hundred years ago. On the other hand, there are some very progressive experimental teachers who are constantly looking for new ways of attuning the teacher's teachings to the issues and issues of our time and the psychology of the people of our time. And those feel like the ones who are doing the kind of cutting edge work you're calling for and that is so desperately needed. And in some ways, they're much more alive.
But for you personally, went off to help Amasura Das and others, with a retreat, is there an iteration of one or more of these traditions that you're involved in that you're like, ah, here's an element that could be sort of updated to express an inclusion of the meta crisis? And this is for both of you.
I think they can all be updated to include that expression. I don't see any reason why any tradition couldn't be. Traditions are a mix of information, insight, wisdom, practices, and transmission. And I don't see why any of them can't be and shouldn't be updated to address the issues of our time. If they don't, they're dead. And traditions tend to fossilize. There's a concept that Peter Russell introduced of truth decay. And Brother David Stendelrass talks about the great traditions as being birthed in this kind of volcanic explosion of spiritual insight into another realm, white hot revelation, lava flowing out, and then with time flowing further and further away and cooling down and ossifying.
Yeah.
That's the risk with every tradition. It requires constant rebirth, and the people who do the constant rebirth are what Jung called Gnostic intermediaries. They're people who take the teachings, traditional teachings. Jung referred to transmitting wisdom across cultures. He said, to transmit wisdom across cultures, you have to first imbibe the wisdom, then you have to learn the language and conceptual system the people you want to communicate to, and then you have to translate so as to create an aha, of course, experience. Well, we need Gnostic intermediaries who are not only communicating across cultures, but across eras. And that's your role. I mean, if I were to give you another another identity, you've got lots, but I would say you're a Gnostic intermediary, translating the traditional wisdom into the metaphors and vernacular and psychology and needs of our time. And bless you for doing that. It's desperately needed.
You remind me of a project that I'm attempting. So when I came to Vancouver Island 8 months ago, after 30 years in the Bay Area, I was looking for my people. So I looked for, Zen communities. Oh, there's not a lot going on here. Looking for Advaita Vedanta. Ooh, no luck. So I said, okay. So I kept looking and looking, and I found this Jewish mystic, but he's like old school, right? One of these like ultra orthodox. Oh, I don't know if this is going to work for me. So I met with him anyway. He was actually quite open. And so the last time we studied together this old text called the Tanya, I said, how does the tradition hold the metacrisis? And he says, what's the metacrisis? So I had to define my terms. And we started having a productive conversation. And I said, I wasn't coming to you to do this, but I attempt to pull in, if I can, different traditions and teachers. What do you think of doing a public thing at your synagogue or somewhere else or on YouTube? That's a great idea. Now, I don't know if it'll work out really well. Like, to be honest, we'll see. It might. There's a whole tradition of, they call it tikkun olam, healing and repairing the world. And, he's like, no, that's in our wheelhouse. I'm like, really? Well done. So I'm so looking forward to learning from him the Jewish mystical path to meeting the metacrisis. And it's the same in Sufi and Christian, and I'd like to do them all, but we'll see how long,
Beautiful. Well, Jonathan, as we come towards the end of our dialogue here, what's calling you now? What are the next steps for you?
Well, the first one is to finish this paper, an open letter to non-dual teachers on non-duality in the metacrisis. It feels it's my joy. Will it be effective? We'll see. It's kind of none of my business. What is my business is to write the best paper I can, hopefully with John Prendergast, and invite non-dual teachers to do a gentle stretch and bring the know what the metacrisis is, read up on it, read Jonathan Ralston's Tasting the Pickle, watch, Daniel Schmachtenberger, educate oneself. So my message will be, educate yourself and integrate. Those two. So that paper, I'm going to invite people to just an open Zoom meeting to investigate. I want to hear from other people. These are just, my first thoughts on non-duality in the metacrisis. This is an open inquiry. It's not mine. I maybe is the first person to put those words together like that, but so what? So let's have a kind of co-created thing where we come on together Zoom. It can be 10 people, it can be 100 people. So I'm really looking forward to that. I want to convene conversations about bringing our spiritual traditions and the metacrisis together. And then, as always, really helping people to find, to be able to describe their default purpose and move into true purpose. So I continue as purpose guiding is sort of my day job, is really helping people discover. And more important than discover is embody. How can I really embody, whether it's a classical awakening or a soul purpose awakening, in a way that is consistent with the Bodhisattva vow, that is consistent with love without boundaries.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, Jonathan, you're doing wonderful work. We need it desperately. I think we both just wish you all the very best with what you're doing. Thank you so much for being a guest here. And let me just say to our listeners that if you found this conversation helpful and inspiring, as I certainly have, you might want to consider attending the Integral Conference of North America, which will have a number of talks and discussions and dialogues around these similar issues. And that's going to occur in Denver in May. I think it's May 16 to 18. A wonderful group of people, smart, usually psychologically and spiritually informed, deep practices. So I think John and I both love that community and think this conversation is a beautiful taste of some of the dimensions of that the conference will try to address. Jonathan, thank you so much. What a gift, and what a gift to us all.
Well, right back at you. This podcast is a gem. I so appreciate what you two do. It's an honor and privilege to be invited on your podcast. Thank you.
And I just want to say what a beautifully integrated spiritual offering you give. I mean, you've really taken, you know, from the past, our ancestors and all the stuff that we learned and screwed up on in the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s, et cetera, and brought it up into a way that's just absolutely nails it and is absolutely absorbable and useful and very high, but very imminent at the same time. And it's been a real honor and a real privilege. Thank you.
Great to be with you too.
Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.